Iran's president condemns the U.S. military presence in Syria, saying it is doomed to fail. An Israeli settler shoots dead a Palestinian teenager near Afula hours after regime forces kill two young men in a raid on a refugee camp in Tulkarm. And fighting in Sudan enters the fourth week as warring parties meet in Saudi Arabia to hold their first round of direct talks. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's president has condemned a U.S. military presence in Syria, saying that it's doomed to fail. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in an interview with Syria's official news agency, Sana'a. He said that Syria will foil U.S. plan to occupy parts of the country to plunder its wealth. Raisi noted no foreign military force should be present on Syrian soil, adding the main concern of regional countries is the restoration of Syrian sovereignty. The Iranian president returned to Tehran on Friday after a two-day trip to Damascus. Iran has executed the ringleader of a separatist terrorist group responsible for several terrorist operations in the country. Habib Farajullah Shah pleaded guilty in court after he was captured in 2020. Gisu Misha Ahmadi has your details.
Showing absolutely no remorse. These are the confessions of the man that led the Harakat al-Nizal separatist group, responsible for several terrorist operations in Iran that left over 450 casualties in a span of 15 years.
According to our plan, our members received military training. That is because we wanted to give the impression that Harakat al-Nizal is strong and can carry out military operations. We even started our activities with an attack on the governor's office inside the city in a residential area.
Based on the theory that the end justifies the means, the Swedish-backed terrorist ringleader masterminded one of the deadliest terror attacks in Iran. In 2018, the attack on a military parade in the southwestern city of Ahvaz killed at least 25 people and injured 70 others, many of which were civilian onlookers.
You could say that all of those who were killed or injured in the attacks were ordinary civilians. We really didn't care. Even many of them were Arabs, and that was okay. We just wanted everyone to know about us. We want people to know Harakat al-Nizal.
The Harakat al-Nizal terror group has been pushing to separate the southwestern province of Khuzestan, which is home to Iran's Arab population.
Arab, Turk, or Persian, we are all Iranians and we will always remain united.
I took part in this funeral to show my support for the Islamic Republic and our leader Ayatollah Khamenei. We are one and nobody can divide us.
Today, I came here to send a message that we will always remain united.
Habib Farajullah Cha'ab, nicknamed Habib Osaivand, head of the terrorist group, was arrested in 2020. He stood trial in 2022, where he pleaded guilty and was convicted and sentenced to death. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence, and he was executed on May 6. His mission remains a failed plot. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The Israeli regime continues with its atrocities against Palestinians. An Israeli settler has shot dead a Palestinian teenager near the city of Afula. A 19-year-old Diyar Omari succumbed to his wounds shortly after he was shot. And there are currently no more details about this incident, but earlier Saturday, a funeral was held for two young Palestinians killed by Israeli forces during a raid on the refugee camp near the city of Tulkarm in the occupied West Bank. The two Palestinians were in their 20s. Latest Israeli violence brings total number of Palestinians killed by the regime in the West Bank this year alone to 111. Around 20 of those victims have been under 18 years of age. Saturday's killings come amid rising tensions in occupied territories where Israel's been stepping up its crackdown against Palestinians. Our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candiel, joined us earlier with more details on reaction of resistance groups to these killings.
Palestinian resistance groups issued numerous statements vowing to avenge the killing of the young Palestinians, and said that Palestinians have the right to resist the Israeli forces and that they will not remain silent. Anti-Israeli operations will continue. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves. Recently, we have been witnessing the formation of newly armed resistance groups. First, there was the Lion's Den and Jenin's brigades, and now there's also Tul Kerem brigades who had been adopting a number of anti-Israeli operations and shooting at Israeli military checkpoints and at the illegal settlements near Tul Kerem.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators taken to the streets of Tel Aviv and other cities throughout occupied territories protesting against the Israeli cabinet's judicial reforms. Israeli media estimated 110,000 people demonstrated in Tel Aviv alone. People chanted slogans and waved flags, while some called the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a dictator and his cabinet a fascist of one. The mass rallies continue to be held despite Netanyahu putting the controversial reforms on the back burner for the time being, after opponents organized some of the biggest street protests ever witnessed in Tel Aviv and across occupied territories. Now, Israelis have been holding these rallies for 18 consecutive weeks since the judicial overhaul plan was presented in January. Reforms will give the Israeli cabinet greater control over the judiciary. Critics say it will remove vital checks and balances and hand unchecked power to the government. The Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has been witnessing intense street battles as the army and RSF paramilitary group are fighting for control of territory despite ongoing truce talks being held in Saudi Arabia. We discussed this issue further with our guests earlier in our news review program. And I welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And now fighting in Sudan enters a fourth week as warring parties are to meet in Saudi Arabia to hold a first round of direct talks. Khartoum is witnessing intense street battles. Envoys of Sudan's army and paramilitary rapid support forces, also known as the RSF, are now in the Saudi port city of Jeddah for talks. Two sides have reached multiple truces in the past weeks, but none of them has held. The truce talks brokered by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia come while the Army and the RSF have made it clear they'll only discuss a humanitarian ceasefire. Fighting has derailed in an internationally backed plan to usher in civilian rule following years of unrest and uprisings in the African country. And now joining us for the program is Abiyomi Ezekiwe, editor at Pan-African Newswire, joining us from Detroit, Michigan, and Jonathan Ofa-Ansa, publisher at Africa Briefing, joining us out of London. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. We're going to start in Detroit there with you, Mr. Ezekiwe. Hope you're safe and doing well. Haven't spoken to you in quite some time. Hope you and the family are doing well, sir. Huge significance, Sudan. A lot of people don't realize what a sensitive country this is, and how important it is for peace with its neighbors in that part of Africa, for there to be stability in this country. Tell us about the significance of a secure and stable Sudan and why it is so elusive, especially after they removed Omar al-Bashir, to get to a more stable Sudan for the people. What's the holdup?
You're correct. Geostrategically, the Republic of Sudan is very significant because it borders seven other countries on the African continent. It also has the strategically located Port Sudan, which connects the country to other regions, geopolitical regions in West Asia. So I think the stakes are very high in regard to coming up with some type of sustainable ceasefire in Sudan. It appears as if Saudi Arabia and the United States has the most influence over the two parties. They've been able to bring them together. So we can only hope and speculate that they will be able to exert the necessary political and economic pressure on them to declare a ceasefire so talks can resume on the actual transition of the country from military rule to civilian rule.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Jonathan Ofa-Ansah, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Mr. Ofa-Ansah, it's funny to Mr. Ezekiel's point, he mentioned Saudi Arabia and the U.S., they're trying to broker this so-called ceasefire. But my question to you, a lot of people feel that these are the two players that helped the country get to where it's at today. We know that in the war on Yemen, the Saudis have been using young 9, 10, 11-year-old Sudanese soldiers, child soldiers, in the battlefield there against the Ansar movement. We know that the U.S. is the reason that Sudan got split and is, you know, fallen on the kind of days it has as of late. We know that between Sudan and neighboring Libya, the U.S. has had a direct hand in the complete annihilation and instability of peace and a decent life for the civilians of those two countries. Are these two players friends of the Sudanese?
Well, one would say, well, yes and no. You know, during the regime of al-Bashir, the U.S. Declared Sudan a state sponsor of terrorism, okay? And it was during former President Trump's administration that when, after Bashir was, I think, was overthrown, when the Trump administration removed Sudan from that list of state sponsors of terrorism, and also lifted economic sanctions against the country after Bashir was ousted. And again, like you mentioned, the Sudanese army has been supplying troops to fight on behalf of on the side of Saudi Arabia in Yemen. So I could say Saudi Arabia is more or less a friend of Sudan, and U.S. has only become a friend, okay? So if they were not concerned, you know, they were not alarmed at what is going on in the country, those two countries, you know, I mean, big powers. I mean, Saudi is a big military power, and we all know that the U.S. is a global power. They would have come together to try and initiate, you know, a ceasefire negotiations in Jeddah. So for now, I could say, yes, maybe they are friends, but we're yet to see how good or how bad, you know, friends there could be to Sudan.
Thank you both for giving us your time and joining us on the program. Stay safe, both of you. Mr. Abiyomi Ezekiel there joining us from Detroit, Michigan, and Mr. Jonathan Ofa-Ansah joining us from London. And that brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Now, another prominent pro-war figure has been targeted in Russia. Zakhar Prilipin has been wounded in a car bomb attack that left his driver dead. Attack occurred in the Nizhny Novgorod region. Russian authorities said they arrested a suspect who admitted to the act on behalf of Ukraine. That, in fact, the suspect is a Ukrainian native, and he acknowledged detonating the bomb remotely. Prilipin was taken to a hospital. He's in serious condition. And he is the third prominent pro-war figure to be targeted by a bomb since the start of the Ukraine war in February of last year. Russia has blamed Ukraine for the deaths of journalist Daria Dugina and war blogger Vladlen Tatarsky in the two previous attacks. Kiev denies any involvement. As the world watches the UK crown its new king, scandals and protests cause an upset on the occasion. London police launched a crackdown on protesters planning on calling for an end to the monarchy in Britain, while polling ahead of the day suggests that the British royal family is as unpopular as ever since records started being kept. Robert Carter has your details from the royal stronghold of Windsor.
Britain now has a new king. At the first coronation the world has seen in 70 years, the Archbishop of Canterbury crowned British royals Charles and Camilla at Westminster Abbey on Saturday, ushering in the reign of King Charles III. The main focus of British state media was the splendour and grandeur of the spectacle. However, controversy still surrounded the day. Anti-monarchy activists belonging to the peaceful Not My King protest movement were rounded up and arrested ahead of the coronation. The arrests included group leaders.
It's a completely peaceful demonstration. The police, without telling us why, without telling us where they're taking them, have arrested all the rallying organisers. They've seized all our placards. It feels like something out of a police state because we still don't know why anyone's been arrested and we still don't know where they're taking our people. You know? Britain's meant to be a democracy, but Charles isn't treating it like one.
Even before the event took place, criticism of the royal family remained relatively widespread. A survey by the National Centre for Social Research showed public support for the monarchy has fallen to a historic low. A total of 45% of respondents said either it should be abolished, was not at all important, or not very important. Young people particularly expressed embarrassment over the institution's continued existence. Elsewhere, similar polling revealed that many of the King's subjects across the Commonwealth would vote to remove the UK monarch as their head of state, raising speculation that more nations will ditch the Commonwealth in the near future. The ongoing cost of living crisis, undemocratic power, and seemingly endless scandals are among the many reasons experts believe the UK royals' popularity has plummeted.
I don't think anyone can be happy, especially looking at the economic state right now. Well, you only have to go out in the streets and some of the famous streets in London and look how many people are suffering and sleeping on the streets. And that is quite embarrassing and appalling for any sort of government, let alone a monarchy, to be proud to celebrate and spend that amount of money when people are suffering.
Why there are many mainstream platforms. So what the royal family stand for today might be different, but it's very, very difficult to erase history. And they have to respect that a large portion of the public still connect them to, let's say, some incredibly sad, vicious and violent times.
The new monarch now faces many challenges, and they're not just including the social, economic and political crises which plague the nation, but also the deep divisions within his own family as well. Depending on how the king handles these many crises, could heavily impact the fight for survival that the royal institution now finds itself in. Robert Carter, Windsor.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. could run out of cash by June 1st. The nation officially hit its $31.4 trillion debt ceiling in January. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to ABC News, the U.S. risks being unable to pay its debts for the first time in the U.S. history. As early as June 1st, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen wrote in a letter to House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and other top lawmakers recently, in which she urged Congress to act as soon as possible. Yellen's update further underlined both the stalemate between legislators and the White House and the potential financial and political risks should the stalemate not be broken in the coming weeks. She wrote, "We have learned from the past that limit impasses, that waiting until the last minute to suspend or increase the debt limit can cause serious harm to business and consumer confidence, raise short-term borrowing costs for taxpayers, and negatively impact the credit rating of the United States. The debt limit must be raised or suspended in a way that provides longer-term certainty that the government will continue to make its payments. Default would not see the U.S. unable to pay all of its bills at all once, but it would fall behind on some amount," the Treasury Secretary has singled out Social Security and military payments. Meanwhile, RT noted U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned recently that the federal government could run short of cash to pay its bills as soon as next month without a debt limit increase. Yellen wrote in a letter, "After reviewing recent federal tax receipts, our best estimate is that we will be unable to continue to satisfy all of government's obligations by early June, and potentially as early as June 1st, if Congress does not raise or suspend the debt limit before that time." She urged congressional leaders to protect the full faith and credit of the United States by acting as soon as possible. "We have learned from past debt limit impasses that waiting until the last minute to suspend or increase the debt limit can cause serious harm to business and consumer confidence, raise short-term borrowing costs for taxpayers, and negatively impact the credit rating of the United States," Yellen wrote, adding, "If Congress fails to increase the debt limit, it would cause severe hardship to American families, harm our global leadership position, and raise questions about our ability to defend our national security interests." The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, also updated its forecast, warning there was a significantly greater risk that the Treasury will run out of funds in early June because of weaker-than-expected tax collections. The CBO had originally projected that a default could happen between July and September. The warnings come after a month-long standstill in talks on the matter between the White House and Republicans in Congress. Yellen has been voicing alarm since February, when the United States hit its $31.4 trillion debt ceiling. At the time, she notified Congress that the Treasury had begun resorting to extraordinary measures to avoid a federal government default. Recently, President Joe Biden called all four congressional leaders and invited them to a May 9th meeting on the issue. Meanwhile, Tesla and Twitter chief executive Elon Musk, who has been calling for U.S. government spending reductions, said recently that a debt default was just a question of time. Musk wrote, responding to a Twitter post by the White House, that the Republican plan may be to default on U.S. debt. "Given federal expenditures, it is a matter of when, not if, we default." Recently, U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Kevin McCarthy warned in a speech at New York Stock Exchange that the U.S. debt is unsustainable and poses a threat to the nation. He said that Republicans would not allow the country to default on its debt, taking a jab at President Biden for refusing to negotiate on cost-cutting measures. McCarthy added that the House of Representatives would soon vote on a bill to raise the debt ceiling through 2023. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden has urged the Republicans to first release their proposed budget, with the White House stressing it would not negotiate the debt ceiling until the GOP releases its counter-proposal to the administration's budget plan, which was put out in March. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said late last month that Republicans were threatening to wreak havoc on U.S. economy, saying that it was time for the GOP to stop playing games and agree to pass a clean debt ceiling bill. In January, the Treasury Department notified Congress of the start of extraordinary measures until June 5th in order to continue paying the government's obligations, as the U.S. has reached its $31.4 trillion debt limit. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen then called on lawmakers to act promptly to increase borrowing limits in order to avoid a default.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. And since today is the day following the Battle of Uhud, in which Hazrat Hamza, peace upon him, the Prophet's valiant uncle, was not just tragically martyred, but his liver torn from his body and chewed by an Arab infidel. Let us listen to the Prophet's saying on the importance of pilgrimage to the graves of the righteous. Whoever visits my grave, but does not visit the grave of my uncle Hamza, has indeed been unkind to me.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get rid of bad habit of lying. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're going to start our discussion this session again with a very important question. And this question, someone has said, I know well that lying is one of the vices, but I practice it easily in small and great situations. But I don't know how to get rid of it. Please guide me. May Allah reward you with good. It's a very honest question, and an answer, I would like to say that every action may change into habit, whether it is good or bad. So we have to be in our mind. And lying has become a habit to this kind of person. Although it will be difficult, but this person has to defeat this habit by being very careful for a period of time until it changes into its opposite, which is truthfulness. But there are some steps that we can carry them and we can practice them in order to get rid of this bad habit. Firstly, repent and ask Allah to forgive you the sin before death surprises you, and then you would go to the painful punishment that Allah has prepared for the liars, by reminding the end of the story of our life. In this kind of case, we can help ourselves to refrain from these bad habits. That's why it is mentioning in Quran and Hadith is the ill-ended story life of these kind of people. Secondly, be alone with yourself. Ponder on the reasons that have led you to this vice and try to finish off those causes in order to get rid of the result. Thirdly, compare the advantages of truthfulness and the harms of lying on every side, like family, society, and individually. For example, you can read some books in this concern, and then the motives of straightness will be able to treat your case. They were the three steps, and for the second part, we're going to count the rest. Welcome back there, brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farad, your host, and I'm honored to have you as my listener. Okay, the previous part, we count the first three steps of getting rid of our bad habits. And now we're going to the rest steps that we counted together. Fourthly, we should custom. We would say to such a person who is suffering from the bad habit of lying to accustom yourself to do good deeds such as reading religious books, pondering on the hereafter, helping the needy, being dutiful to parents and teaching others what you have learned of religion, because this kind of behaviors makes you powerful of stopping and refraining from bad habits you have. Fifthly, you should always remember that this tradition, we have a very important tradition related to the bad habit of lying, and that is narrated that a believer does not feel the pleasure of faith in his heart until he gives up lying, whether it is done seriously or jokingly. Sixthly, you should think that if your lying is uncovered before others, which it undoubtedly will be, then what will your situation be and how will you meet with that embarrassment? Thinking about this result makes us to understand the severeness of this bad habit, and that therefore makes us to stop from lying, and also it helps us to refrain from this bad habit and to stop our soul and our desires of lying. Seventhly, you should know well that a liar has no dignity near people, and also near his relatives. And think about this question, that do you want to be worthless near people? So, I hope with these practical points that you are able to rid yourself of a feature that you know well to be one of the worst vices, inshallah. Thank you for listening to us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
First days of January. Part 1.
The beginning of the year in early January, these days always have a special feeling for me. I was born 22 years ago in such days in a village in the province of Aleppo. I've always had these feelings in me in early January. Perhaps none of my friends, relatives, or even I thought that after 12 years of my birth in this land, events would happen that would change the course of history. I am Fatemeh Ali, a student of journalism at Allame Tabatabwe University in Tehran. In my country, due to the war in Syria, I was forced to leave school and immigrate to Iran. The shy little girl in the town of Nubl, whose biggest concern was the half-hour drive away from the University of Aleppo, today writes stories for us that include hundreds of volumes of books. Today is my birthday. My friends have invited me to listen to my travelogue. Like me, they too have endured the hardships of exile and immigration. Today I was supposed to tell them the story of my 1.5 years of absence from my hometown. It has been a year and a half since I have been counting the moments to kiss my mother again and hug my father and see my siblings again. tonight, after a year and a half of absence from home, I am finally with my family again. The sound of workers working in construction sites in my city indicates that life has returned to this area. Four years of siege, famine and starvation. 4 years without gas and electricity during the bone-chilling cold of northern Syria. This is only part of the suffering of the cities of Nubl and Al-Zahra. In those days, the dreams and wishes of the people depended on the fighters fighting outside the city. Those whose hearts burned like ours and did their best to not let the city fall into the hands of the Takfiri terrorists. Human aspirations are very diverse depending on their circumstances. Perhaps one of the dreams of a girl in the besieged cities of Nubl and Al-Zahra was merely to see the sun rise tomorrow. Some nights, as the sound of shooting got closer and closer, I felt that that night would be the last night that I would see my parents' faces. The sound of laughter next to the citadel of Aleppo had a great message. The battle is over. The terrorists have fled and the people will return to their homes. The atmosphere in Aleppo has now returned to the days before the war. Aleppo experienced a very bitter battle and felt the heartbreak caused by the battle that killed more than 500,000 people and displaced millions. Damascus, the capital of Syria, was wounded, but it refused to collapse and give in. This city is one of the oldest cities in the world. Its inhabitants of all religions and sects lived in peace for centuries, without any war or bloodshed. But suddenly, it became face to face with a phenomenon called Daesh and al-Nusra. It is the shining pearl of Levant that slowly regains its calm. Western media is trying to cleanse the Takfiri's terrorists of their crimes. They divert the attention of the world to conflicts between the nation and the government, while the terrorists are raiding people's houses. I will never forget the weekends I spent in my city, even if Daesh destroyed the amusement park in Aleppo and destroyed my childhood memories with it. The newspapers do not describe how innocent children were massacred, but I learned from life, under a siege, how to tell a story. When such conditions surround me. We were going to become one of the largest economies in the Arab world, and we were all moving towards that goal. However, it seems that the smoke from these factories and the turn of the economy in Syria had greatly annoyed the Persian Gulf sheikdoms and the Israelis. So they decided to stop our progress. When I had to leave the country due to the war and travel to Iran, I had to travel from Aleppo to Damascus. The route was normally 4 hours, but during the war, it took 10 to 11 hours to travel. Even those armed to their teeth did not dare to cross it for fear of their lives. But what happened today is more of a miracle. It is as if the martyrs have brought eternal security for Syria.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has boosted its military presence at Mexico border. The move comes days after the White House authorized the use of reserve troops to combat the international drug trade. The decision to boost the number of troops at the border comes as Title 42 is set to expire on May 11th. Title 42 was put in place during the coronavirus pandemic to allow the authorities to quickly expel migrants who try to cross the border. Once the policy expires, officials expect to see a large increase in the number of migrants attempting to enter the U.S. In this regard, We have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies. For further details, stay tuned for more. According to Guardian, officials are bracing for the end of Title 42, which allows the U.S. to expel non-Mexican migrants without a chance to seek asylum. Joe Biden will send 1,500 troops to the U.S.-Mexico border, the Pentagon said recently, in preparation for a possible rise in immigration when COVID-19 border restrictions lift later this month. The 90-day deployment of active duty troops will supplement the work of the U.S. Border Patrol, but will not carry out law enforcement duties, said Brigadier General Pat Ryder, a Pentagon spokesperson, in a statement. The force will be in addition to an ongoing deployment of about 2,500 National Guard troops. The deployment comes as Title 42 restrictions, which allow U.S. authorities to rapidly expel non-Mexican migrants to Mexico without the chance to seek asylum, are set to end on May 11th. Donald Trump activated the policies during the pandemic, and Biden had expanded the controversial public health measure despite criticism from immigration advocates. Biden has grappled with record numbers of migrants caught illegally crossing the U.S.-Mexico border since he took office in 2021. Republicans have criticized Biden for rolling back the hardline policies of Donald Trump, which some Democrats and immigration activists also have lambasted Biden for gradually toughening his approach to border security. Pentagon leaders have long been frustrated about military deployments to the border, privately arguing that the mundane tasks are better suited for law enforcement agencies and can affect military readiness. Immigration advocates have criticized previous efforts to send troops to the border. Bilal Al-Askriar, the interim campaign manager of hashtag Welcome with Dignity campaign, said on Twitter, "People seeking asylum should be met with humanitarian professionals, welcoming volunteers, and medical and mental health professionals, not soldiers." According to RT, the U.S. military has said it will deploy 1,500 troops to the border with Mexico in order to fill critical capability gaps, saying additional manpower is needed due to personnel shortfalls at the Customs and Border Protection Agency, CBP. The Pentagon announced the decision recently after Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin approved a temporary deployment to assist CBP efforts at the southwestern border at the request of the Department of Homeland Security. Pentagon spokesperson Pat Ryder said in a statement, "For 90 days, these 1,500 military personnel will fill critical capability gaps, such as ground-based detection and monitoring, data entry, and warehouse support until CBP can address these needs through contracted support," adding that military personnel will not directly participate in law enforcement activities. During a press briefing recently, Ryder noted that the troops would arrive at the border by May 10th and that they would be active duty troops from the Army and Marine Corps. However, he said the military is looking for ways to replace these deploying forces with reservists or National Guard personnel after 90 days are up in order to return those active duty forces back to their home stations. There are currently around 2,500 troops deployed at the border, most from the National Guard, who are assisting CBP with detection and monitoring and aviation support. The Pentagon spokesperson continued. Asked whether the increased militarization at the border was in line with President Joe Biden's vows to overhaul U.S. immigration policy, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre argued the deployment was a common practice and stressed that military personnel will not be interacting with immigrants or migrants. Instead, by serving in other roles, she said the troops will free up Border Patrol agents to perform their critical law enforcement duties. Recently, Biden has issued an executive order authorizing Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas to use active duty ready reserve troops at the U.S.-Mexico border to fight the illegal drug trade, which he deemed an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security. The order came after the White House declared a national emergency in relation to international drug trafficking in 2021, handing the president additional powers to address the issue. A number of Biden's Republican rivals, including 2024 hopeful and former President Donald Trump, have also proposed military solutions to problems at the border. In March, a group of 20 GOP lawmakers put forward a bill that would designate various drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, while the Senate has proposed similar legislation as well as a dedicated task force to take on drug gangs.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues pertaining to India's involvement in the South Caucasus region and also the rupee becoming the trading currency between India and Malaysia. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the growing relation between India and Armenia and New Delhi's resistance to the establishment of Zangezur Corridor. And we shall also take a look at rupee coming up as a trading currency between India and Malaysia, thus reducing the monopoly of the dollar.
Since decades, the South Caucasus has played a relatively minor role in India's foreign policy. However, over the past several years, the scenario has changed. The geographical location of the South Caucasus countries being important has provided a viable corridor for India's connectivity with Russia and Europe through Central Asia and Iran. The region also has the potential to meet some of India's requirements of raw material and technology, including oil and gas, minerals, and also gold and uranium.
In the past few years, there has been a gradual interest in the region, and New Delhi's strategy towards the Caucasus countries has seen a change. There have been economic and political developments indicating India's growing interests in the economic and infrastructural potential of the South Caucasus. However, India's interests in the region are not at par with those of other global players. Yet at the same time, the region's importance for New Delhi cannot be ignored owing to its geopolitical location. Amongst the South Caucasus countries, Armenia is relatively the closest partner of India.
Armenia is the only country in this region with which India has a treaty relationship. Fresh impetus to political interaction was provided by Prime Minister Modi's meeting